The next case on the court's oral argument calendar is 8th Judicial District Court, Stephen Grierson, Robert Bennett, Clark County v. Ronald Fox, Clark County Deputy Marshals Association, case number 66114. Mr. Kamler, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Chief Justice. Good afternoon, Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court. My name is Gregory Kamler of Kamler Zucker Abbott. Appellants have conferred with one another on their allocation of time for oral argument. With the court's permission, I will first address the court for 11 minutes on behalf of Appellants 8th Judicial District Court, which I will refer to as EJDC in my oral argument, Appellant Steve Grierson and Appellant Robert Bennett, followed by Attorney Robert Freeman of Lewis, Bruce, Boyd, Bisgard, and Smith, who will speak on behalf of Appellant Clark County for 2 minutes. Appellants would like to jointly reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This oral argument addresses four subjects. First, the constitutionally mandated separation of powers among separate branches of government. Second, the district court's improper imposition of an unconstitutional joint employer relationship on the EJDC and Clark County. Third, the EJDC's authority to employ deputy marshals, given the judicial branch's inherent authority to administer justice in a safe and secure environment. And finally, the fact that Ronald Fox is not entitled to a Step 2 meeting in arbitration because he chose a post-termination merit personnel hearing from the county, voluntarily foregoing the remedy provided by his employer, the EJDC. I will address each of these topics in turn. In the recently decided case of City of Sparks versus Sparks Municipal Court, this court clearly enunciated the guiding principles for the case bar. While respondents have spent considerable effort cobbling together an imaginative and entirely self-serving argument from sections of county ordinances, statutes, out-of-state cases, and pre-City of Sparks cases, in so doing, they ignore the substantial Nevada constitutional issues that are addressed in the City of Sparks decision and at issue today. City of Sparks makes clear that the judicial branch is a separate constitutional entity, has the authority to manage, direct, and control its employees unencumbered by the determinations of the other two branches of state government. A court's direct control over employees, including determining the wage of those employees, is necessary to ensure its survival as an independent branch of government.
But should the marshals know who their employer is? Isn't they have a right to know who their employer is?
Absolutely, Justice Sherry. And they do know who their employer is. Their employer is the AJDC. And Judge McKee got it wrong. He got it wrong by creating a new branch of government called the joint employer relationship that has no place in this universe.
And why is that? That sounds like a reasonable disposition. What's wrong with it, Mr.
It sounds reasonable, Justice Sherry, but you know what? It's not a new theory. It's not a new model. In fact, it was tried in a case called Zelestra versus Piva, a Washington state court decision where they also had issues where the executive was in charge of the money and the judiciary wanted to control the terms and conditions of employment. And that was the resolution there. What's interesting about Zelestra versus Piva is that was, as I understand it, it was an executive branch court. When the same issue came up in Illinois Supreme Court, by the Illinois Supreme Court in a case called Orrick versus Illinois State Labor Relations Board. And that's a 1989 decision. The Illinois Supreme Court looked at this model where one branch was going to control the money and the other branch, the judiciary, was going to control these judicial employees for wages, terms, for terms and conditions of employment, but not wages. The Supreme Court in Orrick said, and I quote, concessions regarding salary will often be linked with some favorable modification of other employment terms and vice versa. If accounting were intransigent on a salary issue, it might prevent agreement between employees and the chief judge as to other working conditions. It thus becomes obvious that the counties and the court could not practically bifurcate quote-unquote employer authority so that the counties might bargain salaries and the courts might separately bargain other terms of employment. You can't just give a part of the baby to one branch and expect the court to maintain the integrity over its inherent authority to manage its employees.
Mr. Kamer, I'm over here. Correct me if I'm wrong. Again, I know five of us were Clark County District Court judges before going to the Supreme Court. And I know when I was chief judge, there was an interlocal letter agreement between the court and the county specifying what employees are under direct control and supervision of the court, and I believe at that time were bailiffs, I believe now called marshals. That was a defined category, like law clerks and court clerks, court recorders, not reporters, but recorders and all. Did that change or what? What's the status of that when this cause of action arose?
Justice Gibbons, with regard to the letter of understanding, there is still a letter of understanding between the county and the courts, and that letter of understanding is dated October 21st, 2008. It still controls. From a standpoint of elaboration of the separation of powers doctrines, you can have a letter of understanding if it's voluntary. Two of your cases have set the parameters of compelled cooperation or inappropriate delegation of authority. In the first case, Commission on Ethics versus Hardy, a 2009 decision, which I think many of you on this bench have decided, that case made clear that the branches of government cannot waive constitutionally based structural authority. Thus, any statute, compulsory order, or attempt by one branch to cede its inherent power over its employees would result in an unconstitutional undermining of the separation of powers doctrine. Yet, in another case that this court decided, because of the need for the branches of government to work together, in the case of Board of County Commissioners Clark County versus White, this court identified the mantra, the modem, the way in which we're supposed to operate. And I quote, "There's an expectation of cooperative effort among those branches of government to implement the functions of government. Accordingly, the separate branches of government must be allowed to find the common ground where they can work together without ultimately ceding or losing their inherent powers over their employees. Here, both the EJDC and Clark County strive to work together properly, as you've pointed out, Justice Gibbons."
Counsel, we have this kind of situation. We have marshals, we have a letter of understanding, but we also have this agreement between the marshals collectively and the 8th JD. And in this equation, this letter of understanding says the county will do certain functions for the 8th JD. Why do we have this mess?
Let me clarify that, because it confused me too when I first got this case. There are two very separate documents. One, the memorandum of understanding, is the equivalent of a non-288 collective bargaining relationship. It is a contract, was a contract, it expired and was not renewed, between the EJDC and the marshals. That stands over here. The letter of understanding is an agreement, an intergovernmental agreement, interbranch agreement, between the county and the courts, and it stands over here. In that intergovernmental agreement, the courts and the county voluntarily agree to work with certain functions. It's not a compelled obligation. Where the court below went wrong is it compelled a new element of government, this joint employer situation, which the Illinois court has not said is unworkable, and which I believe Article 3, Section 1 of our Constitution says is unworkable. The court is the employer of its employees. This court held the same way in Harvey when, in the second district, the court took control of the clerk's functions. And there was a constitutional argument of whether you could eliminate or sidestep a county clerk that was an ex officio clerk of the court. And the court said, Justice Becker, in writing that decision, stated there is nothing wrong with a court taking control over the inherent functions of its employees and their functioning. And if the court wanted to take over the clerk's functions, it could do so. And that was upheld, and Harvey lost that decision, and the second district court judges won.
Are the JEAs, law clerks, and court clerks also employees of the 8th Judicial District? Are they county employees? Are they both? Or what's their status?
Justice Sherry, the concept of being employed by both just can't work. You can't serve two masters at the same time, not when you have inherent powers that belong to a separate branch of government. So to answer your question, they are employees of the court. The EJVC has to be able to control the critical functions to administer justice to maintain the integrity of its processes. If you lose that, you lose the separation of powers.
Is there any issue that the DJs are state employees? So we have state employees, and we have district court employees. The district judges are state employees.
The district judges are a separate branch of government. When you say a state employee, are they taking direction from the state? No. And you don't want to. And does the state control how you operate and make decisions?
All I'm asking is, does that have any relevance that they're not JPs and they're not municipal court judges? They're state judges. Does that have any relevance to this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't want to tell you that what you're saying is irrelevant. But what I do want to say is that for purposes of the separation of powers argument, what you call it doesn't matter. What matters is who's controlling essential functions, such as your salary, such as the salary of the employer, such as your terms and conditions. The state can't tell you to punch a clock. The state can't tell you what your hours of employment are. When you, as justices, feel you need a certain level of security to feel safe in the decisions you render and in securing this building, you make that decision.
Was there clarity in how the employee who had employment problems, how they should grieve?
That goes to the question of whether Mr. Fox, who actually got this dispute teed up to the court, how Mr. Fox is entitled to, or what he's entitled to for purposes of due process. Fox is not entitled, as response would hold, to a redo of his employment separation.
Well, let's go back. Not a redo, but was there any clarity? Was there for lack of something else, a personnel manual that said, as an employee of, from your standpoint, the court, he must grieve this way?
Justice Douglas, absolutely. And you provided the answer to that question, which was the memorandum of understanding outlined that he was supposed to make a request to a second step as part of a memorandum of understanding that would have led to an arbitration hearing. Instead, and it was gamesmanship on behalf of the union and council, the demand for a second step was made on the county.
You're talking about the memorandum of understanding between the 8th Judicial District Court and the County Deputy Marshals Association.
Yes, Justice Perry,
correct. And that is a little confusing because there's separate memorandums of understanding.
But my job is to make it unconfusing.
Right.
And if you look at the record, the memorandum of understanding is at the joint appendix at 36.
Right, that allows for the step two.
That allows for the step two. And the letter of understanding was between the county as to what functions, such as hiring and screening,
the county was not a party to the County Deputy Marshals Association.
And yes, Justice Perry, and they refused to be a party. And the union knew that. And the union still made the demand on the county for arbitration. The county refused. And then they said, okay, fine, we'll go under civil service. And civil service, as a procedure, was under the letter of understanding. So they elected another option. What they should have done is made a demand for arbitration on their employer, the EJDC, in which case Mr. Fox would have gotten that. But instead, he got a full and fair due process hearing through the county civil service process. And therefore, now having lost his pre-termination hearing, having lost his civil service hearing, he comes before this court and says, well, I want to have an arbitration. You can't have it that way. You could have had an arbitration, but you blew the time limits. You didn't properly request it, and you had your hearing, and you lost. How many tries are we prepared to give somebody when they've been fired appropriately?
I guess the question hasn't been briefed is, why would the county even entertain that if we have this relationship between 8th Judicial and the Marshals Association? Why didn't they say, go back, that's your only remedy. We don't do this.
They, in fact, said, we're not going to give you an arbitration hearing. And then The head of the union said, we're in fine. We'll go for a civil service hearing because the union was intent on making the county the employer of the marshals because they felt they could make more money if they were classified as marshals. And Mr. Fox, to his detriment, got thrown under the bus in the process. That's opinion. But that's obviously, when you look at it, what happened here. I want to just close up my remarks by saying this. And I've thought a long and hard about this. On the one hand, the judiciary and the executive are working together. That's cooperation. That's the way the government has to work to serve the taxpayers and the voters. That's all about life. On the other hand, Judge McGee compelled a relationship, a shotgun marriage. That's not allowed. It's the same difference between a voluntary confession and an involuntary confession. We don't allow involuntary confessions. My time is up. Thank you for your questions. I hope that I've answered them properly.
I think you may have consumed the entire time, but you had a number of questions, Mr. Kamer, so we'll have counsel speak for 2 minutes, and then you'll both will have to share 2 minutes, and we'll add four to the other side.
Yes, Your Honor, may it please the court. My name is Robert Freeman. I am here representing the county, and it will not surprise you to know that the county adopts the constitutional argument that's been made by the Judicial District Court. We think that the proper relationship between the courts and their deputy marshals is an employer-employee relationship. We think that that best serves the constitutional issue that's involved in this case. We think that best protects the integrity and the independence of the courtroom. We think that that best reflects what really goes on in this building, that the courts supervise, manage, and direct their deputy marshals and other employees. And we think that that most faithfully reflects the actual issue that's involved in this case. This is a job, at the core of this case, is a job performance issue. Even under some kind of model of co-employment, this would not be the kind of issue that would come to the side of the co-employer who pays. This would come to the co-employer who hires, fires, trains, supervises, and disciplines their employees. And so we think that the deputy marshals are properly employees of the court. You asked a question about whether it could be whether you could separate out their compensation packages somehow from their performance packages, and Mr. Kamer made a good point, and I want to emphasize it. I think the judges have to know, they know what they need. They know what they need, and they know what they have to pay to get it, and so for them to relinquish the control over how those people are reviewed and compensated gives up vital control over employees that are integral to what they do. Now, I wanted to also visit very briefly on two other issues that Judge McGee, I think, got wrong, and one of them has already been brought up. Judge McGee held that the county was obligated under the Memorandum of Understanding. That obligation, and if that's all my time, I'll sit.
Finish your thought.
No. Yeah, that obligation was to provide Mr. Fox with a Step 3 arbitration. Clearly, it's already been pointed out. It's pointed out in the papers. We're not a party to that agreement. It's not part of what we didn't negotiate. We didn't sign it. The agreement that the county signed was a letter of understanding in 2008. In that agreement, if you can read it, the obvious intent of that agreement was to acknowledge that the county was going to provide human resources services to court employees. It was not intended to grant some kind of authority to the court to go out and agree to some other more complicated disciplinary system, and then some come back and say that the county had to abide by it. We made those points in our papers, and if there's no questions, I'll sit with that.
Okay. Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. First of all, on behalf of Ron Fox, there are two parts of this case. One is the Ron Fox part, and one would be the broader part. I'll answer Justice Cherry's question in the second part of my argument. Regarding the Ron Fox part, Justice Gibbons asked about documents. There was a letter of understanding, which is also what we used to call the interlocal, that was entered into between the court and Clark County. And that was in existence during the time most of you were district court judges. It was still in existence today and was in existence during the applicable period of this argument in front of Judge McGee. Under that contract, the county was to provide personnel services, human resources services, to the court. And the day-to-day operation of the court, in terms of discipline, et cetera, was obviously with the justices. That's no difference than corporations when you have direct line and dotted line authority. It's no difference than goes on in every courtroom where a judge could tell a clerk, who clearly is a county employee, what to do.
Mr. Marks, I understand that. I appreciate you confirming that, what my understanding was. But this City of Sparks case, subsequent to the time we all left the district court, does that change the dynamics?
Not at all, because of this reason. In answer to Justice Cherry's question, there's a separation of powers, and I think my worthy opponent confused state with executive. There's a separation of powers, executive, legislative, and judiciary, operating horizontally and vertically. It operates in the state horizontally, but it operates vertically, federal, state, and local, meaning City of Sparks is local. Chapter 3, which created the district court, goes back to 1866, approximately 2 years after statehood, and it specifically answers the questions in this case. It says the judges are state employees and have statewide authority. Judge McGee could be appointed to obviously sit in Clark County. The clerks, and it mentions the clerks specifically, have countywide authority. And it says the district court organization is with state judges operating in the various districts, which are basically defined as counties. And as Justice Pickering pointed out in your concurrence and dissent in City of Sparks, the Devine case answered the question under NRS 3.310, where a district court judge had attempted to circumvent the idea that the bailiffs, the attendants, were county employees and hire his own employees. This court some 70 years ago in Devine said, no, you can't do that. That violates separation of powers. Because specifically the statute provides that if you need more fuel, stationery, or attendants, you go to the county commission. The county commission actually appoints the bailiff or marshals upon recommendations of the judges, et cetera. But the day-to-day functioning is with the judges. Now, in Ron Fox specifically, because this is obviously his case, he attempted to fire the MOU, which the 8th Judicial District Court judges wanted. They wanted their marshals to have a fair hearing before an independent person under AAA. They wanted someone that had law enforcement training, not an assistant manager who's part of management, who's part of the executive branch. They wanted someone independent because these are post one certified peace officers under 289. So they wanted AAA. But in doing the memorandum of understanding, knowing the interlocal letter of understanding, which is the separate document between the court and the county was to provide, quote, comprehensive personnel services. So it was logical step two went to the Director of Human Resources. All that director had to do was to do step two, deny it, and there would have been AAA arbitration. He refused to do step two, and therefore the system broke down, and instead he said, I don't believe in the MOU, I'm not bound by the MOU, even though contractually we think he was bound through the interlocal, and he refused to give an arbitration. My opponents have created a constitutional crisis that doesn't exist. As we speak, probably thousands of labor arbitrations, either through CBAs or AAA, are going all over the country. The issue for Ron Fox is, was he terminated with or without cause? An independent arbitrator should decide that. There was no need to be here and make this into something it's not. There's authority under Devine, and there's authority, obviously, if you read closely, Chapter 3. Judge McGee wasn't looking to create a constitutional crisis. Remember, this came on a stipulated set of facts on cross motions for summary judgment. A lot of the facts my opponent has argued in front of you were not the stipulated set of facts. But clearly nobody disputes the MOU and nobody disputes the interlocal. I think the question the county and court can't answer is, if in their brief they say Ron Fox is a court employee, if you believe that to be true, we don't, but if you did, why wouldn't the MOU apply and he get his arbitration? How can they say to Mr. Fox, you're a court employee, but you don't get your arbitration, you have to deal with the county merit selection process. That's illogical, and it's not consistent with the written documents, the MOU, or the letter of understanding. Additionally, we think Judge McGee bent over backwards to avoid a separation of powers crisis. For instance, in Galloway, this court said judges, district court judges, can't license ministers or other people that perform marriage ceremonies. The legislature had given them that power. You, as the Supreme Court 50 years ago, said, quoting Montesquieu, you can't give judges legislative power that could lead to tyranny. You can't give judges executive power that could lead to oppression. This system has worked. Five of you were district court judges. You know it works. Judge McGee asked for comity between the branches, meaning the legislative branch that basically gives the money, and the judicial branch that takes the money and spends it on their staff, and asked for comity, saying no branch can move to their extreme position of power, or the system of checks and balances and separation of powers wouldn't work, be it state, local, or federal. And he asked for comity, saying, in every decision, each branch can't operate in a vacuum to the full extent of their power. But you can rule in Ron Fox's favor and give him his arbitration without deciding any constitutional issue at all. The marshals that we represent, because the court, after ruling, allowed the court, the district court, Judge McGee, allowed the 8th Judicial District Court and the Marshals Association to intervene because there's an ongoing problem, who is the employer. That comes up if a marshal is sued, for instance, in 1983. Do they turn it over to the DA? Do they turn it over to the AG? They're entitled to know for their own protection who their employer is. Importantly, they're on the portfolio of employment with the county. In other words, they're listed as county employees in the county code. They're budgeted through the county commission. The tax ID number for federal taxes is the county ID number. Human resources is through the county. FMLA, you have to go through the county. Affirmative action or EEOC issues, you have to go through the county. Everything you have to go through the county. In the county org chart, or organizational chart, the court administrator is really a division director of the county. He's the division director of the 8th Judicial District Court. And under Chapter 3, it specifically says the in-court clerks are county employees. In fact, the in-court clerks have a collective bargaining agreement with the SEIU. So it clearly, they're employees under 288. The argument by the other side, not our argument, would tend to create a new level of employment that the legislature hasn't ever authorized. Judge McGee looked at 284, it would be state employment. And again, that could be executive, legislative, or judicial. Or 288, which is local government employment. And that could be executive, legislative, or local judicial, and that's the city of Sparks issue. But we're in Chapter 3, which specifically is dealing with district court. Keep in mind that the bailiff marshals are post-run certified. So they basically have the qualifications that the legislature set up under Chapter 289. And under 289, they're therefore clearly executive branch employees. You recognize under separation of powers that you don't have a private police force in terms of the district court. Clearly, your police were authorized by the legislature as state employees under 284. But there is no authorization in Chapter 3. So Judge McGee carefully looked at the MOU. He carefully looked at the interlocal. He looked at Chapter 3. He looked at the Galloway and Devine decisions. He looked at the Nevada Constitution. And he said this system, which has been in place arguably for 150 years and has worked, is constitutional and is valid. In modern parlance, in modern labor parlance, it's co-employment. And it's co-employment because obviously there's certain IRS tax issues, clearly they're county employees, and yet the judges have day-to-day control over discipline and telling the marshals what to do in their courtroom. And there's nothing inconsistent. The Supreme Court of Washington approved that model. Supreme Court of Pennsylvania approved that model. Illinois has a different system where it's a unified system. It's not run on a county basis. But if you read the Zylstra case, it's virtually identical to the situation that we have in Nevada where we have the district court judges are state employees, but they operate within districts, and their support staff is county, specifically clerks and marshals. So we think on these cross motions for summary judgment, when the facts were not in dispute, at least the material facts, Judge McGee's decision should be affirmed. It will not create a constitutional crisis. It will not create a new category of employee. It will tell the marshals they're under 288, they're local government employees, they're county employees, and it will provide some much needed clarity to a situation that, because of infighting between the court and county,
your argument, Mr. Mark, seems to take out an equation for me. What if the judges believe that the employees of the court are underpaid?
Okay.
What then?
They can request, there's a rule where they can
constitutionally,
ask,
what then?
They can
constitutionally.
They would ask the county commission, who is on
the court, compel the county to pay the compensation that the court believes is appropriate for its employees.
Under 3310, arguably, if there's not sufficient attendance, they can get that, they could, and then ask the county the sheriff to pay the bill. Under 3.310, it contemplates if the county
doesn't... It's a statutory answer. Under the Constitution, what is the authority of the judicial branch to require the legislative branch to properly compensate its employees? Consider, for example, the Young case out of Pershing County. That case suggested the judiciary has the authority to compel such a requirement.
I think you do, as long as it doesn't violate Devine, unless you decide to overrule Devine. In Devine, one judge from one district decided he wanted multiple bailiffs, and I think Judge McGee asked the question, what if you have a paranoid judge who wants 50 bailiffs? Could that judge on his own hire 50 bailiffs? I think we all know probably not. Clearly, 3.310, and consistent with the separation of powers, if the functioning of the judiciary was impeded because more security was needed, the court could get the security and through the sheriff's office and bill the county. That's statutorily provided and constitutionally provided.
Isn't Clark County different, though, in terms of you're talking about the sheriff? The sheriff has been out of the equation for intents and purposes for quite a while.
The sheriff has been out of the equation in terms of the marshals are not part of the sheriff's department. The statute's never been amended, so presumably the chief judge of the 8th Judicial could contact Metro, the sheriff, and say, I need police, I need more security. Let's say it was an emergency and you couldn't get to the county commission, there was a bomb threat or whatever. You clearly would call the sheriff, get all the police you needed, and they would bill the county. That's provided for statutorily. It's consistent with City of Sparks that you have inherent authority to have whatever security you need, but consistent with Devine, a court paranoid district court judge in Judge McGee's example can't decide to hire bailiffs on his own because that would violate separation of powers because the budget process goes through the legislature. I think it's very consistent. But it depends on comedy. Our whole American separation of powers depends on comedy. In Devine, the Supreme Court, your predecessor court, said this judge had no reasonable fear that he needed more bailiffs, that there was a process to get him through the county commission, and you ruled that his actions were unconstitutional.
But isn't the rule in Devine aimed at a reasonable assessment of the decisions in each of the branches? That one branch can't make an arbitrary decision that is adversely affects the other branch.
Correct.
That's what Devine's talking about.
Correct, exactly. So therefore, if there was a bomb threat in the building and you needed more security, you could procure that through Metro, which is obviously the police department, and bill the county. And you'd have every right to do it constitutionally and statutorily. I think you look at the statutes first, and if the statutes and case law answer the question, you don't create a constitutional crisis that's not needed. That's never been the way this court has looked at things.
It seems like, though, the basis for any a relief by Mr. Fox is found in the agreements, not on statute or not on the Constitution. That's your
correct.
Argument.
It's found on the agreements, but the agreements, importantly, are consistent with the statutes. If the statute said that the attendants were state employees, then there would be a conflict, a la Galloway or Devine. What I'm pointing out is Judge McGee carefully looked at Chapter 3, which has worked for 150 years, and found the agreements to be consistent, reading the agreements and the statutes together. He ruled in Mr. Fox's favor, and there's no legal reason to reverse that grant of summary judgment in Mr. Fox's favor.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Marks? Okay. Mr. Kamer, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I want to just point out that the controlling law here is Article 3, Section 1, which sets up our separate branches of government. The concept of joint employers, while it may work sometimes in the private sector, can't be compelled in the public sector where you have a separation of powers. The statutory provisions, which learned opposing counsel cites to, can't trump the Constitution and can't trump the analysis of this court in City of Sparks. The 8th Judicial District Court's marshals are their employees. And to create this new creature that's going to share power by compulsion offends the Constitution. And this court got it right in City of Sparks. Justice Pickering's dissent spoke in terms of the fact that the county and the court hadn't had enough time to bring this to an impasse. Well, the EJDC and the county didn't have an opportunity to bring it to an impasse. Judge McKee compelled that they were now going to be joint employers. And that's where he got it wrong. And this court has recently addressed the superiority, logical as it seems, and as appropriate it was in the Thomas case. A constitutional amendment trumps a statute. Article 3, Section 1, City of Sparks trumps any of the arguments of opposing counsel. If it was voluntary, it would be constitutional. Compelled, it becomes unconstitutional. Doesn't matter that it lasted for 150 years. If for 150 years it was voluntary, in order for the court to maintain its independence, it must direct, manage, and control its employees. I thank you for your time and the opportunity to argue in front of you today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kamer. Mr. Marks, thanks for your input and your arguments here, and Mr. Freeman as well. The matter will stand submitted.